And now, Dustin, take the wheel.
Thank you. So, first things, please open the app. We are doing this live question thing that should be kind of fun. I hope it comes up on the screen. Oh, it did come up on the screen. Thank you. So the first question is, are we seeing more new businesses created thanks to an increased efforts on entrepreneurship? I don't know if we have a live answer. Is it like an A-B thing? There we go. More, 100%. But it's one person that's answered so far. But anyway, we'll skip and we'll just go for it. It's actually fewer, which I think it was surprising to me to learn. Opening new businesses is actually down 25% since before the recession. And I think that's an interesting fact that people should know. If we go to the, see, now people are, it's going down because you guys heard the answer. So we go to question number two. Hey, look at that. Okay. The basic question is, are new business failure rates rising? So we have fewer businesses. We're seeing some, either people must be scared to start them. So yeah, answer that. Are we seeing fewer, or are they rising or falling, the failure rates? You may see where I'm going with this. Rising. Nope. Now, wait, hold on. See, I gave it away. You guys read my body language. Truth is, it is actually falling. They're closing 30, the failure rate is down 30% since the 70s, since the late 70s. So we have fewer people starting businesses and they're more successful. So why, they don't really jibe, right? Like, we should have more businesses being started because people are becoming more successful. So on that note, I wanted to kind of start with a general question. I think all of you may have something to say on this. A lot of people in here may want to start a business, but there is a fear factor to it. I know I'd be terrified. So why don't you give me kind of a small window as to why did you do what you did? Why did you go out and start your own business? There's a high risk. Failure rates are falling, so maybe it's not that big a deal. But give me kind of a quick rundown on why you founded your business. And Tarun, I want to start with you.
Sure. So honestly, for me, it was just I wanted to do something that I thought would create value. And not to say that you don't create value in other lines of work, but my background was in strategy consulting, and I did that for about 7 years, and primarily client services work. And so you're helping establish businesses, and the nature of the problems are interesting and challenging, but I just didn't feel the same level of ownership. And my mind was always whizzing around different ideas, and I was contemplating how I could take some of the things I learned and do something impactful. And I just felt like ultimately, if you don't do something entrepreneurial, like for me, I would never get that real opportunity to take ownership and create value and drive something the way I really uniquely wanted to do it. And so it was definitely scary. I mean, I think the fear factor exists. There's no way you can go jump into something, leave a established role with established income, and not be scared. But at the same time, it's such an uniquely intrinsic motivation when you do something on your own, and you're scared, but it drives you to move forward. And I've never worked harder in my life, but it's fun. You wake up and you're just excited to do what you do. So that was really how I felt about it. And I got more and more comfortable in that role over time. And I'm still kind of learning exactly how it works, but it's exciting. And the fear really is the motivating factor in some ways.
Sure. Amanda?
So I never thought that starting a company was something that people did. When I graduated, I grew up in like a very lower middle class blue collar family. Everybody got jobs, worked in the auto industry, worked in schools, and that was it. And so for me, I graduated college in the middle of the recession. My very first job was at a startup advertising agency, and I was the first employee. And we grew to like 15, 20. And I think that was totally an exposure to what is this? I started Googling, I'm like, what is a startup? Like, I had no idea. But I got such a great firsthand experience of building a company. I hired people, built processes, and that was what was exciting to me, building something, and building something bigger than yourself. We also sort of started Bamboo by accident. We were four friends who came together. There was nowhere to go downtown. And we wanted a place that was affordable and really welcoming so that while you see the resurgence happening downtown, everyone had sort of a place to go where they could start getting connected and be a part of something. So we were just four friends sort of grinding it out in this space that we convinced one of our partner's dads to give us an opportunity testing out this idea. And we just got started that way. And so it was a little bit of not knowing what we were doing, but also being exposed to that, this was even a path that we could take. And I think, you know, if we're thinking about some of the facts you just mentioned, I feel like Detroit is going through this culture change back to our entrepreneurial roots. And I hope more people start to get that exposure through conferences like this.
Brief off question here. Why the name Bamboo? I've always wanted that.
One of our partners, Dave, when he was at school at University of Michigan, read about the bamboo plant. It's one of the fastest growing, strongest plants, but it takes a few years to sprout from a seed. And he thought, that's a great metaphor for starting something. It does take a while until you hit that, sometimes we call it like market fit or that right product. And I think that was like just a good metaphor for what we wanted to do. We wanted to help other people start companies and work on ideas with us.
Did not expect it to go that deep, all right. And Veronica, I think, I mean, if you don't know Veronica, her story is amazing, but I think, you know, you probably have a sort of a different answer, I would imagine.
A different, and then there are definitely similarities between some of the things that you were just talking about, too. And, you know, I didn't even know what the word entrepreneurship was when I was going to college. Again, my parents are still struggling with unemployment and poverty. I grew up in a situation where we were constantly moving around and evicted. And for me, Empowerment Plan was a class project in the beginning. And it allowed me that freedom to experiment, to try things, to prototype without that fear of this being real. It was still in that space of being a student. And then when it became time for, you know, school to end and for me to graduate, that was when the fear really sunk in, because I had been told by professors and things like that to say, you're gonna go, you're gonna work, you know, you're gonna take your classes, and then you're gonna go work somewhere else for a while. And what you're doing is really adorable and super cute, and that's so nice of you for wanting to help people, like pat on the head. But you need to get back, like you need to get into consumer electronics, you need to get into a different world. And so to break away from everything that I was told I needed, to, like that I had to do, that I should do, and actually go about it when I felt like, one, I don't know anybody that's ever started a business. No one in my family certainly has. And I thought entrepreneurship was reserved for a higher class of person. I thought it was reserved for somebody that had money and connections and this network of things that I did not have. And so for me to make the decision to start Empowerment Plan was very challenging, and it required me talking to a lot of people and going through the process of here's what it's gonna look like, and then telling myself the day after I graduate college, I'm gonna go and go to work there. And I was like, I don't even know what that looks like yet. But that was a huge leap. And knowing for me what made that leap okay was I figured, well, if I fail and it goes epically wrong, I will still be broke and living with my grandparents, because that's where I was at the time. I was going to school and I was living with them and I had no money. I was like, well, it will net out the same. I will still be broke and I will still have nothing. And worst case scenario, it doesn't work out, but I will still have my college degree. I will still have all these things. And having grown up in the situation I grew up in, I know it's better than what I experienced. It's better than, you know, the kind of rock bottom experience. It's better than going back to that. So I'll still be in a better position. And I'll at least have helped a few people. And that was really exciting to me, that even if it didn't work, that there were still people that said their lives were better because of their experience.
Sure. So with that, what was your direct first step? So you got started in college. You kind of threw caution to the wind because you couldn't get, you know, you'd still be living on the couch of your grandparents or bedroom, whatever.
There was a whole room. I had a whole room, my whole guest room.
That's better than I did. what was your first step? I mean, you wanted to make this a reality more than a college project. So what was that first step?
The first step was pretty funny because I didn't fully understand the process. You know, if I had taken any business course ever, that would have been a great first step, but I didn't. So what I heard was that it was amazing the response from people on the streets that had been displaced for decades. I ended up with like a street name that I still have in the area of NSO, which is the Crazy Coat Girl, or the Coat Lady for short. And it was amazing that people were coming up to me asking when the coat was gonna happen. They're like, they had seen me with prototypes, they had seen me walk around with a bunch of people. They're like, I hear you're the coat lady, when is this gonna happen? I was like, never. It takes me 80 hours to make one coat. This is not an efficient process, and this isn't gonna be real. But enough people asked that I figured the first step was like, okay, so I need money. And I knew that in order to get money, I had to have a business plan. I had never seen one, never read one, didn't know what it looked like, so I did a designer's business plan, which was 15 pages of pictures. It had five sentences total and said we needed $1,600 to operate for a year, because I was really good at math. And I showed that to whoever would sit down long enough, because I didn't know anybody. So I got a meeting with the dean of College for Creative Studies, because I was like, I give them money every year to go to school. Shouldn't they give me money to start my business? That is not how that works, just an FYI. To anybody interested in going down that route. They said no, but he connected me with somebody that could get that first amount of money. And that first person was the CEO of Carhartt. And they donated the first three sewing machines. They donated fabric, materials. They had me go and shadow their manufacturing facilities across the US. And then they also gave me the check for $1,600, like, here you go. And I was like, I walked away like I had won the lottery. That was the largest check I had ever seen in my entire life. And I was calling everyone. And basically that business plan said we just needed three sewing machines. That was it. That was the only line item. There were no thread, fabric, people, space. But all of that, that came later. But that was the first step.
Interesting.
Very interesting.
But hey, lucky to know. So leading back to the polling questions, Amanda, for you, you know, failure rates are lower, but we have fewer businesses. Does that mean that, I mean, because you're operating in this area of basically helping people be successful or maybe failing a little gentlier?
Yeah.
explain the kind of the ecosystem that has cropped up in places like Detroit. I think it's a national trend, but certainly Detroit, and how that's aiding in people's ability to really do better at starting a business.
Well, I think after the recession, we had this big movement of more businesses opening up downtown. Dan Gilbert, being an entrepreneur himself, I think sent this message that, you know, I'm coming down here, you guys should too. And then from there was like a big wave of early stage tech startups that he started investing in. And that sort of sent a message to people like myself, you know, sitting at home freelancing one summer after the advertising gig and thinking, oh, that's really cool. I had no idea this was happening in downtown Detroit. You think about that in other cities, but you didn't think about that in Detroit. And that was probably like 5-7 years ago. And since then, I think there's been a lot more companies started and a lot still around. Detroit, what we always tell people in our founder community, it's more affordable here. One of our members moved here from Toronto, and he originally was just gonna stay here a year, play around with a tech idea he had, and now he has 20 employees. He has a bunch of customers, corporate customers, and I asked him, why originally here, why did you stay? And his response was, everybody was really nice to me. They actually wanted to talk to me. In Toronto, I didn't know my neighbors, but I think there's generally is a sense of community here. There's a sense of everybody's in it together. It's not competitive, it's more collaborative. You go to Silicon Valley or New York, your rent is expensive, your employees are jumping from like best paycheck to best paycheck. In the Midwest, I think we do work really hard, and we have a different set of values, and the companies we also start here tend to get more traction first because it's a little bit more affordable to start.
Sure. Let's move on to you, Sarun. Condor Detroit, you're now at Mobility. The two have merged. Explain kind of why the merger discussion happened and why, you know, I mean, because we're talking about grit and hustle, right? I mean,
yeah.
This allows you to hustle harder, I presume?
Yeah, it's kind of in line with what Amanda was just talking about, actually. I mean, it's such a collaborative environment down here. And so a little bit about the evolution of the business. So we're a month-to-month car subscription service. And I think a year ago, no one really knew what that was. But it's getting a lot of traction recently, not really necessarily because of what we're doing, but a lot of the OEMs, GM, Ford, et cetera, are starting to do similar things and getting a lot of press associated with it. And that was definitely daunting for us because we started out, thought we had this great idea to revolutionize how people get access to a car, and then you start to see everyone with the deepest pockets in the world starting to do something very similar. So a lot of it was around how do we competitively differentiate. And as you know, since you covered it, Mobility and Condor, we started it around the same time, had different paths, but a very similar objective. And I think in a lot of cities, that would have been a, you know, red flag or a reason for us to be competitive with one another. But in all of our interactions, the CEO of Mobility and myself had It was very positive. We talked about collaboration. We talked about what we were all doing individually. And so it just fostered this great relationship. And, you know, we thought about it as all ships rise in a high tide. And there's an opportunity here for us to really build something great together. And we still get to bring that entrepreneurial spirit to what we're doing. But we can collaborate together and build something even greater. And so we're part of the Planet M Landing Zone, which is an effort by the state, by local municipalities to attract mobility companies to the area. And there's just so much cross-collaboration between the businesses, which I think is unique to the region and something that I get excited about being in Michigan specifically. And also just helped us create, you know, we didn't raise a bunch of money from some, you know, VC or something like that. We really funded it ourselves, built a critical mass, and then we're able to build to something bigger through a lot of those connections. So, you know, I think the biggest takeaway for me was you can collaborate with others. You should always think about it not as a competitive dynamic. And all these co-working spaces that are down here, like Bamboo, like others, really foster that type of environment. So take advantage of it and see other players in the same industry as people you can learn from, as opposed to, you know, always thinking about it as a competitive dynamic.
Sure. And I was on the phone with you for 15 minutes, you explaining car subscription services to me at least that long. So do the research. It's actually really fascinating. I want to go to you now, Veronica. Where mobility might want to seek to be a billion-dollar valuation startup. We talk about entrepreneurship and startups. Yours is a social mission. So the benchmarks are different, right? He can look at revenue and look at, you know, balance sheets a little differently. Explain that to me when you're out there and you're hustling to raise funds and you're doing metrics. I mean, what is the idea of success for a socially driven startup?
So in the beginning, it was small. I thought of it as like when I talk to a lot of people that are starting up nonprofits or socially minded organizations, they have this idea of tackling this whole mountain of need, and it becomes very daunting very quickly, and it becomes overwhelming and kind of terrifying that they just don't know who to help first. And for me, starting Empowerment Planet was deeply personal initially. It was, you know, my family's from Detroit for generations, and it was about creating an opportunity I wish had existed for my own parents. And then it became working in this shelter and then making sure that those first 10 people I understood with the coat, that was meeting a need. And that small group got together and it became much larger just based on the population of homeless people in Detroit at the time was 20,000 people. And the coat kept on getting positive feedback. And it was actually through just word of mouth was getting shipped, not just in Michigan, but globally. And I thought that was really interesting. It was just in the beginning about proving that we could make the coat and that it was needed in the community. And then what happened next was about truly identifying and addressing the root cause of why we even need the jacket, which is our goal and our aim is to end the generational cycle of poverty through employment so that people that may need the coat may never have to use it. So if we can go back down even deeper and get even further upstream and focus on the individuals so that they are, you know, they're able to buy their own home and become stable. And we saw that organically happen with the first 3 people I hired. And so that's what we started scaling. So it was very small in the beginning. It was 3 people. We made like 200 coats that entire first year. That was 6 years ago. And just to give you a perspective of how much we've grown, our budget for that entire first year is less than, actually like 25% less than our burn rate per month right now. And so the exponential growth and that kind of that idea of scaling and rapidly scaling impact can happen. So when we look at what we've been able to do, we've made 30,000 coats, but we've distributed them in every US state, all 10 Canadian provinces, and then 18 other countries to refugee camps, to situations of disaster relief. And it's been exciting to see that. So that's one of our metrics that we look at. And then the next one is how many families. So we've hired 60 people, but on average, that's 3 kids per every person that we hire, because we hire parents. And not a single person has fallen back into homelessness once we've hired them. So every single person moves out of the shelter within the first 4 to 6 weeks of working with us, and not a single person in 6 years has ever fallen back. And that's, thank you, thanks. So that's the thing that we're very proud of, and we are a nonprofit that doesn't really fit into any one particular bucket, and it's so hard to say, but like new things don't fit in old buckets. And it's hard to tell and sell people on this idea that is new that makes them really uncomfortable. They're like, well, you're a business, and you make coats, and you can get those sponsored. It's like, but we also do this. But we also impact families. And that's sometimes hard for people to understand. And it's taken a while. And now we're finally at that stage where we're exponentially growing. We just moved into our own building. It's like 20,000 square feet. We were in Pony Ride and like 2,000 square feet for a while. And we're going to be hiring hundreds of people. And so you show that social ROI, not just in, you know, the here's this person, they're making this much money now, they're moving on into other jobs, people are graduating into other employment opportunities, but then you also show it in some of the psychological questions we ask, like how do you feel about your financial future? People are now answering in a more positive light. So those are the things you have to like set those metrics and start really talking about that. And there are people that get behind ideas like that. There are investors that are excited about seeing a social return. And that's what you just have to find those people that align with that idea, that they want to give their money to ending some of the world's toughest problems.
Sure. So now we're going to move from moving people emotionally to moving people physically back to Tarun. This is a car town. You came up with a car idea. But the increased mobility, the actual phrase, not the company, is a really hot topic. I mean, if you read Cranes this week, you see that I wrote about scooters. I mean, now we have scooters and we have, you know, I mean, there's new stuff constantly. It's constantly changing. In the context of Grit and Hustle, I mean, you have to be nimble to adjusting your business plans and models. Are you doing that? How do you do that?
Yeah, it's definitely daunting when you look at the size of the corporations that are trying to tackle mobility solutions, how much horsepower they have behind those.
Right, and that's General Motors, right. Mercedes, but I mean, we're talking massive.
Exactly, and so many of them are here, and so you're kind of in their backyard as a small fish trying to disrupt an industry that is one of the biggest behemoths in the world. And that's scary, but at the same time, I mean, I always think about it from the standpoint of where do you have a competitive advantage? Where can you do something different? And we're, to your point, we're nimble. We're you know, a much smaller company. We can do things very quickly. One of my biggest pieces of advice to folks that are interested in doing something entrepreneurial is just try something quickly. Like, don't try to engineer something to be perfect, because you'll just spend your entire life working on, you know, getting it to a point where it's what you want it to be. Get to a minimum viable product. I know it's a buzzword in entrepreneurship, but get to something that works and go test it. And that was really what we did. And, you know, we had customers coming to us saying, oh, I don't mean to offend anyone that works at GM or anything, but we looked at Maven, we looked at all these, you know, these great solutions, and this actually fit our needs the best. And, you know, I think that was really because we tried to do something really quick that met a very fundamental need, and we just ran with it, and we kept improving it as we went along the way. And it's a very basic technology. I mean, if you go look at it right now, it's a very simple app, simple website, but it meets the underlying customer need. And that was really the focus for us. If I need a car for 3 months, is there a way I can get that and not pay an arm and a leg? Insurance is really expensive in Detroit. How can we help reduce that? So we're trying to tackle fundamental problems that people face and trying to do them very quickly before the industry, you know, gets to that point itself. Because mobility is changing. In the next 10 years, you're going to see more disruption in mobility than I think we've seen in the last 30. With autonomous technology coming online, with electrification of cars, and there's a lot of exciting things coming, but what does that mean for you today? And in a lot of cases, it means pretty much nothing. You're still going to drive your car, and you're still going to fill it up with gas, and those things are the same. So how can we change your life today was really the focus. And then using that as a platform to then think about how can we change your life 10, 15 years down the line, as it comes to mobility at least.
Sure, and a reminder that we will have a brief Q&A at the end, so please go, and I'm sure by now you have questions. If not, think of some. I can't do all the work. So minimal viable product. I always like that phrase. It's you see a lot of that, Amanda. You see a lot of people trying to get to the minimal viable product. Is there something in the DNA of those people and how they're working? Is there something that, some sort of trend you've seen in how they work, the ones that are actually successful? I mean, is there some sort of barometer to the ones that are successful, something you see different from the ones that fail?
That's a great question. I don't know if I'm an expert on what makes anyone successful, sure. But I would say the ones that I think you see, they just don't give up. I think one, you have to really believe passionately in the problem you're solving. Mm-hmm. So for us, it was providing a welcoming space and affordable rent, right? And you have to hold on to that problem that you're solving because you may have to shift what the actual app looks like or what that looks like or a new design. And you can't fall in love with your solution. You have to come almost like co-create a solution with the people you're serving. And that's sort of what the Lean Minimal Viable Product and Lean Startup methodology teach you. I would say the people who have been most successful so far at Bamboo, they've always known they were an entrepreneur or they've discovered it and they just didn't give up on what they were doing, but they definitely shifted their business model, either to get revenue and funding or to jump on that first opportunity. So you have to follow that problem you're solving, but still keep an open mind and you have to balance that approach. And all of us have probably done that. And that's where you start to find out what's that stickiness, where's that fit in the market, what's that short-term value that you can provide that'll get you going towards the long-term vision.
Okay, now I'm going to do sort of some rapid fire here. I want to know what your day is like. Because, I mean, as a non-entrepreneur, right, I'm just a lonely reporter that works a regular job. What is your day like? I mean, you know, I think people, when they think about entrepreneurship, it's you're putting in 100 hours a week, you eat, sleep this, this is all you think about, this is all you do, you don't have a personal life, how could you? Is that a reality or is that just fiction? I mean, kind of give me a hint into your daily life with this, as I mean, it defines your identity in a lot of cases. So you're laughing, so I want you to go.
Okay, so I'm laughing, I'll start. I think there's a point that it can be like that in the beginning where you get invested and you hear a lot of people talk about their businesses as babies, as like their children. And I sometimes have an issue with that language. It's like that's a living thing in person, but this is your team. And these are the people that you work with, and this is a company, and you need to create that healthy relationship with your company.
Sure.
And I think there's definitely a while for which it does take up all the time, and your whole life becomes this thing for a bit. But then there's a tipping point for which there's a diminishing return, where you've dumped so much time and energy, where you don't have much left. And if you're the sole person kind of holding it all up, then it's easily breakable. And I think when that happens, and you try to be like Superman or Superwoman, sure. And you try to take everything, you don't give your other team members or hopefully the people that you're working with an opportunity to take on that ownership and be successful as well. And it's exciting to finally be at this point over the last few years, especially as we're hiring people that have families and more experienced career paths, or that, you know, we have an age range of 18 to 64 on our team. So people have lives outside of this. It's not a startup anymore. These are career pathways for people. And so you need to stop work at like 6. It can't go on indefinitely. People need to go home and have families. So that's kind of forced it as part of our company culture. It's about getting the work done, but then also balancing and supporting people's family lives.
Sure.
And there are things that are going on there.
And with you, the thing that always I just thought was interesting is you're employing people that were formerly homeless or are deep into poverty. I mean, does that weigh on you that if something goes wrong and someone has to lose their job or people lose their job? I mean, you know, that has to be in the back of your brain, right?
It definitely does, and it weighs on members of our, like, the whole team. Like, to say it just weighs on me, it doesn't. There's so many people, our case management, like, people that are right at the front lines of it every day, and it's very hard. You have to look at the big picture after a while. You're like, this is working with this many people, and at this point in time, we have 100% success. So even if we fired somebody, mm-hmm. if we had to terminate someone, they are landing other jobs, and they're maintaining financial stability enough so that they have never returned back into the shelter.
So that soft skill meant something.
That soft skill meant something, so at least while we have people, we're equipping them enough. But there are very, very hard moments, very difficult times when you think, is this going to work? Are we going to be able to do this? But you have to remember like the bigger picture. When it comes to the social side, you have to remember the bigger impact. You're like, okay, this one person may not make it through in the way that we hope. Something's gonna happen or something just happened that's gonna set them off the rails. But you have to go back and
sure.
say, okay, it's working though for this many people. And we have to remember that because otherwise you're gonna get so entrenched in it and it's just gonna stay with you.
Sure. You have a lot of questions?
The last two are real quick. I've got a few questions.
Okay, these are gonna be, so real quick for you two. Biggest mistake you've made, one that you lost sleep over and you still lose sleep over.
Yeah, great question.
Not relationships or anything like that.
I'm gonna be here for a lot more than 7 minutes. So I would say it's not getting, this might be a really odd answer, but it was not getting the peace of mind that I sought really early on. I was so stressed out the first several months of doing this because, I mean, it's a high liability business. You have cars on the road that people can get in an accident, things can happen to them. And, I mean, we went really quickly to market, and so we had an insurance product in place that protects the driver and everyone, but the liability umbrella for us was not very substantial. And so that just made it very difficult for me to sleep at night a lot of the time. And you know, we got through that, and eventually, you know, I was running around doing everything from fixing taillights to meeting with corporations trying to, you know, build our brand. And I think in some cases it's one, just top-down thinking, prioritizing the right things, not paying for stuff that, while yes, it's a small budget, you know, you should make sure that you invest in the things that are going to give you peace of mind. So whether it was getting people to help support some of those activities or getting that insurance umbrella and understanding that that would be, you know, a lot of money to spend, it would have given me a lot more peace of mind, helped me be more effective at what I was doing.
Sure. Amanda, quickly.
I would say making the tougher decisions quicker. So I love people. Bamboo is a community. There's tons of great people around us. But I do believe that you need to hire slow and fire fast, like test out working with people, that culture and that team that you build that helps Veronica step back while her company scales. Like, that's one of the most important parts. Sometimes if someone's not a good fit or they're ready to move on, like, you're helping them by pushing them into the next direction. So
sure.
Those were always kind of the toughest.
Right. I've always benefited from hire fast, fire slow. So, but 10 years later, still there.
You did a good job because you asked some of the questions that the audience was asking.
Oh,
perfect.
But also a question that's been asked a lot is, what's one piece of advice for people who want to be entrepreneurs, but also tie into that, who do you talk to for advice yourself? And I think that's applicable to a lot of people in the corporate world, because how do you, we hear a lot on the professional development side, what we do at the club, about how important mentorship is, how do you find a mentor? So answer both of those questions really succinctly.
I would say talk to your customers. Your mom and dad are gonna love your idea, probably, hopefully. So go find the people who are gonna pay you and get their feedback, and then you need to talk to other founders. They're the only other ones who will believe in your crazy ideas, who will cheer you on when you're about to give up, and who have been through the ups and downs. So we have a lot of founder-focused events at Bamboo. There's some good events in Ann Arbor. I'm happy to point you to any of those anytime.
Yeah, I would kind of echo that. I would just say, when you come to roadblocks or when you look at things that just get daunting, like for me, I remember being like, this is incredibly overwhelming getting an insurance product for this type of program, or how do I legally set up this type of structure? Use your network to get those answers and don't just get overwhelmed by it and let it be a roadblock for you to doing something. Like, you can, as yourself, go start a business in a very hyper-competitive industry and use the networks around you to help answer those questions.
Yeah, I'd have to say one of our first employees was the person that I talked to the most, and it's like that first group of people that started with me that I hired from the shelter, and we were all doing it together, and it created this sense of ownership as a group rather than just the one, it resting on one person, which was really wonderful. So we were all feeling the need to bring this to another level, and we talked openly about the things that we struggled with. And as far as a mentor, it was like an aspirational, you know, the dean of CCS had been like the design director for Patagonia. So there was so much that I could learn, but he had also gone through something similar. And also that had tried and not worked out with some companies, tried and failed, like had gone through that experience, that roller coaster, and had come out the other side, willing to walk you through, like, it's gonna be fine. And that's really wonderful to hear.
Excellent. Your biggest mistakes, how did you learn from it, and what did you take away, and you know, you make a mistake, everybody makes mistakes. How did you grow?
I'll take a stab at that. So for me, I think it was just how to allocate my time. You're very resource constrained when you start something out, and you just try to do everything at once, and it manifests itself in so many different ways where you miss the ball on certain things, you're not at your best, you just overwhelm yourself completely. And for me, it was just, what's the thing that's gonna add the most value at this point in time, and what can I deprioritize? Everything doesn't need to be perfect. And it's taken me a long time, and I'm still working on it, to bring that mentality to the table and focus on the highest value add things. But I wish I did that more early on, because it would have saved me a lot of stress and a lot of just unnecessary effort on things that didn't matter.
I would say not really listening to whomever, whether it's a, you know, for us, it was not listening to some of the team members that we had that may not have felt like they had a voice yet, so they were not openly sharing some things that they were struggling with or some feedback they may have had. And so not getting that faster. So getting that information to the people closest to the product and to the work that we're doing. People sometimes feel like they just want to tell you good things, and they're not going to tell you when things start going wrong, and you're not thinking to ask or push or like get that information or create an environment that really shows that you're listening to them, and that if they're not going to be punished for making a mistake, they're not going to get fired for it or anything like that. You want to learn from that, and they're going to learn from it, and we're all going to try to fix it and solve it quickly. But learning how to listen, the fact I've been hit in the face by so many things where it's like, somebody wanted to say something or somebody didn't say it until it was too late because they just weren't sure. So really learning how to listen to those individuals and asking those right questions was so critical.
I would just say every day you're gonna make a mistake and every day is gonna be different. There might be some major leak in your building or somebody really upset that you have to help out or something that you're afraid of. And just as long as you start to get that mindset of, okay, this is just another problem I'm solved, or this is just another thing that I'm gonna figure out how to do better next time and learn from each experience. Like, once I developed that mindset, it became so much less stressful because you always knew there was a solution and that you were gonna get better from whatever you were experiencing. Also, I'm really bad at listening. Looking back, I would go to lunch or dinner with one of my mentors, and he would always say something to myself or my boyfriend who also has a company, and then like 6 months or a year later, we would do that. And we eventually were like, we should have just listened. And we started implementing it way later than we could have.
Well, I'm afraid I have a lot of other great questions to ask, but we are out of time. I would strongly encourage everybody staying for the reception to come up and ask all sorts of great questions, or certainly all of our contact information should be in the app. Feel free to email or contact us and get in touch. There were even a few questions to me. I'll try to respond. Thank you, everyone.